Everyone is, looks like some people are still connecting to audio. Okay, I think we are ready. The time is now 12:05 p.m. on April 19th, 2024, and I call the meeting on of the Committee on Behavior Analysts to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. Ms. Michelson, would you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Byra?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Ms. Denton?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
Okay, Dr. Stenhoff is absent. We do have quorum.
Thank you. I would like to take this time to thank those who are in attendance today. This is a specially scheduled meeting to make sure that this the complaint that is on the agenda today is reviewed in a timely fashion. So thank you to committee members who devoted additional time to their workload to ensure that individuals in the state of Arizona who receive behavior analytics services have the ability to have a forum for concerns. So as we look through this, thank you to committee members for this. Thank you to board staff for the preparation of the documentation and gathering the details to provide to the committee so we could for thoroughly review this matter and come prepared today with the ability to review this matter. So thank you to all who are in attendance today. We will go ahead and move forward, but I didn't want to move forward without acknowledging the effort that goes into protecting those who receive behavior analytic services in the state of Arizona. The next item on the agenda here is continuing education for maintenance of BACB certification. For those who are in attendance today, you should know that the Board of Psychologist Examiners is an approved ACE continuing education provider. Attending this meeting on the Board's Committee on Behavior Analyst is eligible for continuing education credit for both maintenance of BACB certification and for Arizona licensure renewal. Attendance of this committee meeting is eligible for that continuing education credit if the meeting is at least 1 hour long. Should the duration of this meeting be 1 hour or more, make note of the code words provided by board staff throughout the meeting. To report those code words to board staff for the purposes of earning that continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meeting page for this particular meeting. Please note that it is possible that this special meeting may not take longer than 1 hour. So thank you for your understanding if there is no continuing education that is available. We will go ahead and move into agenda item number 4, which is consideration, discussion, and possible action regarding complaints and recommendations to the board. Before we start the complaint reviews, I'll be sharing some important information for those participating today. Please note that a person or representative of a person who has filed or is the subject of the complaint and is present today may make a brief statement up to 5 minutes to the committee when prompted by me. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after their statement. Only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make this request during the case review. For anyone in attendance today, please make sure your audio remains on mute when prompted by the committee to speak. The complainant, respondents, and their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note that individuals who are in attendance who speak out without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. Please only use initials for patients or children and the complainant. I'm going to kind of hone in on this for a little bit here. Be aware that the contents of many records involved in these complaints are confidential and the content should not be discussed in this public meeting. All parties, including committee members, complainants, licensees, and their legal representatives in attendance for today's meeting should ensure that protected health information is not shared during the review of these complaints. As a child is involved in this review, it is critical that his protected health information remains confidential. This type of protected health information includes, but isn't limited to, this child's diagnosis, his name, his date of birth. The committee may go into executive session to discuss any of those confidential records or to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. The two complaints scheduled for review today are number 24-23 against Elaine Helton and number 24-24 against Candace Marrero. These were filed by the same complainant, and the allegations relate to both respondents. Given this, I will ask the assigned lead for this case, Dr. Davey, to provide the complaint review for both cases together. The complainant will have the opportunity after the lead summary to make comments that are specific to each respondent. Each respondent will also have the opportunity to address the committee with comments. For the record, Dr. Stenhoff is recused from these matters and is not attending today's meeting. Before we proceed, are there any disclosures or recusals that need to be noted at this time? Dr. Rates?
Madam Chair, I would just note for the record that an organization I'm affiliated with was referenced, but I feel that I can move forward in review of the case.
Thank you. Okay, now that we've kind of done a little bit of the housekeeping as far as the important information that needed to be reviewed before we could move forward, Dr. Davey, are you comfortable providing a summary of both of these cases at this time?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll begin with a brief overview around the complainant and the around the complaint, and then the licensees. So, Ms. Helton and Miss, I'm going to get her last name right now. She's going to give it to me.
Marrero.
Marrero. All right. Write that out phonetically for myself. I appreciate it, Ms. Marrero. Our employee is BCBA's licensed behavior analyst at a private school. The complainant's son, JB, was enrolled at that school for approximately 1 year with overlapping school years during 22 and 23. During the time of enrollment, the child was 6 years old and had had previous services from various agencies in the Valley to be able to address developmental disability. There was multiple assessments conducted by multiple BCBAs. We'll start in August of 2022, where a functional behavior assessment and behavior intervention plan was developed by Ms. Helton. This was looking at engaging in maladaptive behaviors that were listed out as elopement, aggression, and then refusal to engage in particular behaviors. In addition to Ms. Helton's involvement, as well as Ms. Marrero, there was also work done by Gentry Pediatric Behavioral Services, where they brought in BCBA as well to take a look at some of the services being provided and provide a consultation. This was brought about by the parents to be able to bring in this extra level of support. That was towards the end of the school year, and I believe was around for 1 month. In addition to that, we have Scottsdale Pediatric Behavioral Services being engaged as well through the parents. Dr. Frias, he was involved in the case from June of 2023 through November of 2023, specifically and germane to this case. Those services were requested. Again, parents helped coordinate that stuff and asked for some assistance to be able to get further treatment gains with the complainant JB. There was an additional assessment and a treatment plan generated during the time that Dr. Frias was engaged in this. In addition, we've got We kind of boil down to some of the more salient facts around this. We've got the complaint coming forward alleging that there was inappropriate use of physical restraints. Respondents have noted that they are PCM and PCMA trained and certified to be able to provide such restraints of transportation. Complainant also suggests that there was a failure to develop and implement de-escalation interventions and that behavior worsened over a period of time. Data shows that there are, in fact, increases of problem behavior during the complainant's enrollment at the school. In addition, that during the time where some of the team decided that the setting was no longer an effective treatment setting for the complainant, that there was not a full or disclosed or developed assessment or treatment, I'm sorry, transition plan developed to be able to transition the complainant from the setting that he was in to an alternative, perhaps school setting, clinic setting, or in-home service setting. There was also some complaint or some mention in the complaint around violation of confidentiality, as well as inappropriate uses of restraints, as well as seclusionary punishment services. The complaint goes on to provide a documentation around that, as well as photos to be able to support what they, I'm sorry, the complaint didn't do this, but the parents did, and particularly the mother, provided that to us so that we could review and look at the incidents reports that were related to those particular photos. The joint response from the licensees states that they did not engage in any inappropriate behavior, that they had conducted a functional behavior assessment, that they had coordinated with external BCBAs to be able to provide services to the child, that they were, in fact, trained to be able to provide the professional crisis management services that they did provide to the complainant, and that certification comes through the PCMA. That's for both some level of restraint as well as transportation of an individual. And they go on to suggest that they did their best to be able to provide evidence-based services in light of the FBA as well as the behavior intervention plan, that when that was not successful, that they did take to heart the information that was provided by outside BCBAs that were brought in to be able to support the complainant and the problem behavior. Madam Chair, that is my summary of this case, and happy to answer any questions from committee members around the summary.
Do any committee members have questions for Dr. Davey regarding his summary of this complaint? Seeing none, is the complainant JB present? If so, please unmute yourself and state your initials only for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement. Up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for you following your statement.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of our son, JB. My initials are also JB. His father is also present. His initials are also JB. So I just want to acknowledge that our family is here, united and representing advocacy for our son. So we're here today, and we're here not only as parents, but we are here as advocates for ethical standards in behavior intervention, especially concerning children with the diagnosis that my son possesses. Our son has taught us invaluable lessons, lessons about resilience, but his journey has also highlighted critical issues. That we believe demand your attention and your action. Our son is a creative, intelligent, and he is a delightful child. He loves drawing, he loves singing and swimming, and he is our family's joy. But he also is a child with a disability, and he faces challenges in expressing himself verbally. And like many children with his disability, he sometimes communicates through challenging behaviors. And research tells us, and you all know this, that as many as 90% of children like JB with the diagnosis that he has exhibit these types of behaviors, not out of malice, but to communicate and to regulate their emotions. In his earlier schooling experiences, JB thrived under evidence-based practices and positive behavioral supports that really nurtured his growth. I'm not going to name those institutions, but they're familiar. And they provided environments where he not only learned, but he flourished. And this was thanks to the caring and competent providers that partnered with us to ensure his success. But his schooling experience took a very distressing turn at the school in which the licensees are employed under the direction of Ms. Helton and Ms. Marrero, and it was really marred by incidents that raise serious ethical concerns. Instead of the nurturing environment that we expected, JB faced repeated restraint and injuries, actions that go against the very ethos of responsible care for children with his disability. And despite his challenging behaviors, we never agreed to the excessive force that was used on him. And despite documented evidence of his positive response to evidence-based practices, he faced repeated restraint and injuries at the hands of those who were entrusted with his well-being. So you imagine your child, a 50-pound, 6 or 7-year-old, being forcibly held face down on a mat 15 times by 3 adults in a 30-minute period. The bruises and abrasions and marks left on his body and his little face, they were not the result of his own actions, but of excessive and unreasonable force inflicted upon him by Helton and Marrero and their team in direct response to behaviors that stem from his disability. This misuse of restraint not only violates ethical codes, but it resulted in physical and emotional harm to our son. These actions are not justifiable. In fact, they're indefensible. And what's more alarming is the lack of accountability and empathy displayed by these individuals, the licensees. The abrupt termination of his enrollment without notice, without a transition plan, just further compounded the harm that was caused, disrupting his progress and his continuity of care. As advocates for ethical standards and behavior analysis, we must not overlook the gravity of these actions and their impact on vulnerable children like JB. But beyond our son's experience, there are 85 other children at that school who may face similar treatment. Upholding accountability is not just about JB, but it's also about maintaining trust and integrity in this field and ensuring that all children receive the care that they need without the fear of harm. And it's imperative that the BACB Ethics Board holds accountable those who disregard ethical guidelines and prioritize the well-being of children with disabilities. Upholding these standards is not just about adherence to rules, but it's about protecting the public. It's about ensuring the integrity of the profession and the trust that's placed in behavior analysis by families and communities who rely on them. And so our son continues to teach us resilience, but he should not have had to endure these hardships. We're very hopeful about his future, but we also demand change, change that puts the well-being of children like him at the forefront and holds accountable those who are entrusted with their care. I urge you, as I hope you have done, to carefully consider the evidence that's presented and take decisive action to address these ethical violations. Our children deserve nothing less than ethical and compassionate and evidence-based care that respects their dignity and that fosters their growth and their well-being. Thank you.
Thank you, JB. At this time, I would like to offer the committee the opportunity to ask the complainant, JB, any questions that they may have. Dr. Davey?
Thank you. JB, your husband has been in there for JB as well to help us with the initials. I appreciate the assistance. Talk to me a little bit about the transition in general, right? So the committee's privy to a litany of text messages going back and forth as we kind of approach this November timeframe, November meeting, where you've got Dr. Frias, you've got Ms. Hilton and Ms. Marrero working towards, perhaps adopting a plan that is going to go in place. We see some discussion about whether or not it's feasible. And then some correspondences between you and Dr. Frias about that meeting as well. So tell me a little bit about the time frame leading up to, hey, this may, whether you're coming to the conclusion or whether you're getting the sense from the team that this may not be the best placement for your son, and what are the alternatives that they are discussing with you, or actions they are discussing with you, whether that be a different school, a clinic-based program, which I believe I saw some mention of in a text. Talk to me a little bit about that discussions that you had going on.
Happy to. I'm not privy. I'll apologize for there will be some vocalizations and requests in the background. We've currently been homeschooling our son since November. Continue to do so is obviously securing school placements mid-year without an effective transition plan and no options leaves us with me being his teacher. I'm not privy to the text messages that were exchanged between Dr. Frias and the licensees. So I can't comment on what discussions or plans may have been in the works. That was a concern of ours that we have this outside provider, and he is already supporting other students in the school setting and already had an existing relationship with the licensees. And there were apparently exchanges of information that we likely were not privy to. And so it did come as a surprise to us that JB would be disenrolled in November. There was very little discussion up to that point. What we believed was that Dr. Frias was developing a plan, that he had done extensive research and gone into the literature. JJ's dad can provide some information on this as well, as we met with Dr. Frias when he was developing this plan. But up to that point, we were just trying to continue to work with the school personnel, even though we obviously had concerns about the management strategies that were in place and the amount of physical force and restraint that was being used. We believed that with the presence of the other provider, who on conscience or lack of training assured us that he would never be dealing with JJ in that way, and to our knowledge never did, we were comfortable with continuing with JJ in that setting, trusting that this team would collaborate and provide him with the treatment plan that he needed. And so Dr. Frias assured us that he was going to go into the literature. I'm just going to need to pause because I've got a client.
JB, husband, I see that you would like to be acknowledged.
Back. Sorry about that. Yes, feel free to jump in if that's okay for his dad to jump in. But I just was going to continue in terms of the plan that was being developed. Again, it felt like a little bit of an 11th hour Hail Mary. I won't lie, because we sort of wondered what has happened up to this point, that now you need to come up with the, literature-based, evidence-based plan to try to, keep JJ enrolled in this school. And our concern was his continuity of his education and the fact that it was mid-school year, and we didn't want the disruption to his schedule. We didn't want to be in the situation we're in now. We didn't want him away from peers. We didn't want him out of a school environment. We didn't want him having a lack of access to his education. And so that's why we continued working with the school, and we trusted that the plan that Dr. Frias developed would be one that he would be able to collaborate with the licensees, and that it would be able to be implemented in the school setting effectively. And it was very surprising when we got the news that as of today, he's disenrolled. And in fact, before that, why don't you keep him home for a few days? Because we need to, quote, consider the plan. Now, I'm no literary genius, but it didn't take me 3 days to read that plan and understand it. And I don't have near the training and background that these licensees do. I have a different kind of background. So the idea that he needed to stay home for days while the plan was considered was something that was really puzzling to us. And obviously, being kept home caused a significant disruption. But from our perspective, and JB, you can speak to this as well, I was very taken off guard by his disenrollment and very disappointed, obviously, particularly in light of what I know about the requirements for appropriate termination and transition planning, particularly for vulnerable children with disabilities.
Did you want to add anything to that, Mr. JB?
Certainly, if I could speak to that, I think certainly JB answered this correctly and exactly in line with our thinking. To your question, Dr. Davey, about the experience, it was very much presented to us as this intervention that we have been trying is not netting the results that we anticipated. So we're going to go back under the hood. We're going to take another look and we're going to assess with this outside consultant what's the right next decision. So as parents in a school dedicated to this vulnerable population, we're working with experts in the space. Our assumption was they're going to come back with a better plan that's going to help us navigate the right next step, because we're all agreed what we're doing is not getting what we want. So the idea, as JB indicated, was a little disarming to say, well, we'll keep them home for a few days while we figure it out. Obviously, that creates a burden on a family to have to make that adjustment immediately. But in good parental collaboration with the school, we said, okay, we will keep them home. We'll navigate that step. And then we're ready to meet and hear what the new revised plan is. And the new revised plan was, we've disenrolled him. And you can imagine how jarring that is as a parent to be told, we're going to consider the right next intervention for your child in a school dedicated to this population, and then be told, we're done. We have, as Dr. Davey, you said in your analysis, we've done our best. We have no additional steps. We're going to disenroll. Not even we're going to navigate this for the next week. We want him to come back. We want him to have this celebratory moment or any of the other ethical things that you would expect a person to do. But to, on that day, disenroll and put a family and a parent and a child in a vulnerable position where the family has to make immediate adjustments is frankly not only unethical, it's borderline criminal. And I think, again, this board should thoughtfully consider the actions of these individuals for the protection of this student, but also for the protection of other students on this violation. So in short, it was a disorienting and disarming conversation when you're presented with, we're going to find a better solution. And that better solution is good luck.
Thank you. A couple of more questions just around kind of the transition period. In the information that was provided to the committee, which just for the record is over 850 pages of documentation that we as a group have gone through individually, there is the contract essentially between the family and the school. And in that documentation, there is a discussion around the behavior policy as they've framed it. And embedded in that is some discussion around the rules around enrollment. And it lists some issues, it essentially defines various levels of intensity around behavior from mild, moderate to severe. It also lists out information around what may lead to disciplinary actions on the part of the school, which include possible termination of enrollment. Do you all remember signing off on that documentation as part of the enrollment packet?
Certainly, if it's in the enrollment packet and our signature is there, then we certainly signed off on that. There are waivers and there are contracts, and then there are best practices in the interest of families and vulnerable children. So while, you know, while we sign, you know, we understand that termination is a possibility. It is in any school situation. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean that the actions reflect ethical best practices. So similarly, while emergency situations may require the very rare use of restraint that does not result in injury to child and that has the child's safety in order, it doesn't mean that it's okay that it becomes a part of the repertoire, or that because you've signed a waiver, you've signed off any concerns that you should have about physical damage, injury, long-term repercussions, psychological and emotional damage, et cetera. So while it may be the case that certainly, yes, we read the handbook and we said, yes, we understand termination is a possibility. It's problematic to sort of...
I understand what you're saying.
I find that it seems a thin veil to me, but mm-hmm. sure. In answer to your question, we understood termination was a possibility, but given the way that the support transpired, deteriorated, and the way that the information was presented, I can speak a little bit more to our understanding of the transition and the termination piece. You know, one of the things that I can share is that the only suggestion that was made to us in terms of an alternate setting came from Helton, who mentioned that I won't mention the particular name of the school, but what she said was, this is another possible school, and it's a school where they can do even more holds. Hmm. So tell me, as a parent who's concerned about verifiable, documentable injury caused by three adults holding my child down prone, causing bruising, marks on the face, et cetera. Tell me how that is a at all logical, ethical, possible transition plan. We can recommend another school where they can do even more of that, that you're obviously very concerned about, because I had expressed my concerns both verbally and via email. So the idea that, well, she just didn't want any other place but the United School is preposterous. We were not offered. It was not a collaborative discussion about what would be best for JJ if the school that we're talking about was not deemed to be the appropriate setting. We would have engaged that conversation, but what was offered was a school where they can do more holds or go to clinic or go home. Mm-hmm. And when we inquired with the clinic, they said we can only do in-home. And guess what? Our son is now 8 years old. He needs to be in school. He doesn't need more in-home ABA support. He's not a toddler anymore. So there was no follow-up. Did you end up getting any services with another agency? Did you end up finding another school? It was, he's disenrolled as of today. Where do you want us to send his stuff?
Thank you for that. Thank you for that information. I think the other question, and I appreciate your comments back to the documentation you signed off. I was just wanted to know if that was even something that you had seen, and I appreciate your conversation around that. When I want to go back to some of the discussions around the behavior intervention plans, some of the plans that were put in place, some of the interventions that were put in place. When you were coming in for these meetings to look at, there's progress report meetings, looks like there's some ongoing meetings where you're looking at graphs. There's graphs produced for you in terms of progress, where at one point we're seeing a little bit of some improvements, and there's some discussion back and forth around that. When you were sitting there with Ms. Helton in these early stages, when you're talking about any intervention, you know, whatever might be selected from the one that Dr. Frias puts forward to something that, you know, may not have a fancy name like that one does, whatever it was called, an enhanced choice or something, ECM, did they, and this can be to either you or your husband, seeing that you're on the move right this second, did they discuss with you kind of the idea that there are risks and benefits to these types of interventions? Did they have a conversation with you with regard to, hey, you know, this may be the most evidence-based one, but the risks for this one are X, Y, and Z. This one may be something that shows to be highly effective in a school setting, but the benefits are not quite as great. Was there any sort of conversation around risk benefit to the selection design and implementation of the behavior change interventions that were being leveraged?
No, I think that's a really important question. And so I'm glad that you raise it. What I can say from those meetings was The licensees were heavy on data. Here's data showing rates of elopement. Here's data showing rates of noncompliance. What they failed to talk with us about very frequently, and given my background, this was something that was also puzzling to me. They didn't talk us through what were the results of the functional assessment. What's going, you know, the things that we have control over as professionals in education and in psychology are the environmental variables. We didn't have a conversation about the salient motivators in the environment. We didn't have sufficient conversations about the preventative strategies that needed to be in place. What were the results of the functional assessment? Was there a preference assessment done? Those things that I would expect to see as part of planning. It was much more, here's this data, here's how he's functioning. But what, there was not a lot of clarity about the actual intervention plan. We had one conversation where there was, and this was early on, and I thought potentially this could be an effective plan, but it was an interspersing of high demand versus low demand kinds of tasks, and it was color coordinated, and I thought, you know, JG might respond to something like that. But absent that conversation, I can't recall any other conversations or documents that I received over email about actual treatment behavior intervention plans. What was discussed was we can do these PCM holds, and it was demonstrated to me how they would be done so that JJ wouldn't experience bruising, and yet adult size handprints and abrasions were evident in the photo documentation that you were able to observe. So we were told that these moves would be done with safety, and that their training was extensive. And Helton even said, you know, when I train others, you know, if they don't have the open hold, then they flunk it. If they have the closed hold, then they flunk it. You know, so we were sort of assured that this would be safe. Otherwise, what parent would agree to such a thing? So, you know, absent those assurances, I don't think that we would have proceeded. And when we started seeing the injuries, we were very distressed, but thought, okay, let's try to assume the best of intentions. That was something that the other JB would often say, you know, as we would talk about these things and even in meetings with the licensees, assume that people are working under the best of intentions and there's not intentional harm being subjected to our child. Mm-hmm. But yet that was not our experience in terms of how he was coming home. And in fact, when he would come, you know, to the car in the afternoon and he'd look literally like someone had wrestled with him, and I would photograph and helped and chastised me and said, what you're doing is making our staff uncomfortable. You need to stop. Mm-hmm. Which as a parent is just absolutely right. Reprehensible that I should be told that concern about my child's injuries is something that I should be really thinking about how the staff feel. I shouldn't want to put them off. You know, that the disempowerment that we've experienced as a family in this situation, because, you know, there's always hanging over you. You argue too much, you're going to lose the spot. Then what are you going to do? And I think that they took advantage of that in some ways. And they took advantage of our conciliatory nature and our amiable, collaborative nature. Would do anything to collaborate. We'll do anything to try to work with the family. And instead, we got emails that said, we don't appreciate your suggestions. You know, let us work our plan. To be clear, Helton said in the email, to be clear, we're going to work our plan. You know, this kind of exchange, it doesn't promote the collaboration. And so in some ways, I guess we shouldn't have been surprised that the termination occurred the way that it did, because we had been given some indication that their collaboration skills were quite in need up to that point.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about not receiving documentation. So there's a functional behavior assessment that is dated like August 20th, 2022.
Very early on.
Mm-hmm. So in August, and committee members, page 292 of the document. So in this particular document is where, you know, when we're looking for that description you talked about of, like, I don't believe you said the word target behaviors, but you were talking more about the interventions that might be leveraged. There are, you know, several pages that go into operationally defining what those target behaviors are that they were interested in. So some noncompliance, elopement, aggression, that refusal behavior that I mentioned previously. And then there is this discussion of behavior intervention plans where they talk about the use of a token board that's tied to what you just discussed, having a preference assessment to make sure we've got the right, you know, make sure they've got the right reinforcers in place. what they refer to as high P sequencing, which is really just going with high probability demands that then lead to that are going to work out for the individual to be engaging in, and then you can move to something a bit that might be a little bit more of a demand in terms of response efforts, and so kind of sequencing that to get some momentum. They've got some discussion around the movement breaks and some pairing. They've identified FCT or functional communication training as well. They do have some escape extinction in there around demands. And so there is that discussion of those interventions that are there. And then it goes into, as you pointed out, that there is a section that is titled crisis management, and where they've identified that the crisis management is around elopement and aggression for an individual, and that they do outline to you that only PCM certified practitioners will perform such things, and that it is about physical blocking for personal safety as well as transportation if needed. There's also a spot for a signature there on that 22 FBA. The one I have does not have a signature, but I'm wondering if you recall going through that as part of like a discussion, and again, looks like at that point where there's some data, things are looking a little bit better in terms of what kind of progress is going on, maybe post this in those quarterly reports. So just kind of like, I know that seems like probably forever ago, but was there a good conversation at that point? I mean, the documentation would suggest that there is some thought here by the BCBAs around what's going to happen, what the plan is, what evidence-based practices they're laying out, and not to put everything in the lens of how everything went wrong later on, but if you can just take me back in time, like, was this a collaborative conversation? Was this a conversation that you and your husband got to ask some questions and be a part of the process? And were you, adequately engaged by the licensees during the review of this document?
If I could start, perhaps.
Oh, okay. Well, that was an early on, but.
What I would just share in response to the two questions, and then JB can provide maybe more context. But from my view, we met multiple times, and to the point that you read there, it was expressed two opposing things. One, we were very overtly clear, I think, and stated multiple times that we preferred not to have JB held or to be physically managed. That was a discussion that we had in multiple cases. That portion of the discussion was, as you read just there, this would only be for prevention. This would only be in critical circumstances. This would only be in specific moments, and it would be for blocking purposes or transport purposes. Take that to getting a near daily in interaction that says that JB has been held down. And into to the circumstance that the other JB alluded to, where a person is held down 15 times in a 30-minute period. That's not trying to exercise an intervention that's not working. That is egregiously wrong, inappropriate behavior that warrants this committee's action against people who took child abuse into a school environment. So it's not a signature on paper in that circumstance. It's
I want to just say one thing. Like, I appreciate I don't really appreciate the hyperbole around like the action, right? Because I think that from the outside looking in, like, I agree that there may be some things off here, right? But there are very clear guidelines for BCBAs and licensees around the use of a restraint. And there is, not necessarily a checklist, but it is, has there been a functional behavior assessment done? Is there a comprehensive intervention plan? Have less restrictive alternatives been tried that are, and maybe they're not effective, or they're not clearly feasible in a particular setting? There's one here that the BCBAs in general did not get engaged in, which was making sure that there was no medical evaluation done and making sure there was no medical conditions that might be contributing. But the other ones are around the problem behavior being serious, right? And to your point, Dad JB, is if a child is putting themselves at risk or others at a severe context of, elopement, running out into a street, like, yes, you would expect someone to physically grab your child and save them, right? And stop them from doing that. Now, if it's, I'm just not going to pick up a piece of paper and I'm going to physically manhandle you, then that's different, right? Those are two dramatically different uses of what we would, fall underneath the discussion of restraint. So I want to be careful with the hyperbole, and it's not to play down your concerns. It's just we need to have like an honest conversation about, you know, what is required by the BACB, by this board, by our own ethics, and, you know, whether or not the BCBAs failed to do those things. And if they did, then absolutely holding them accountable. And so that's what my questions are trying to get to. And so I just encourage you to just let me know, like stick to kind of the facts around it. We have this discussion, we get to those things. I hear your pain and I hear your frustration. So please realize that I'm not trying to downplay that, but I need to get the facts to be able to come to a point where we can adjudicate this.
In my opinion, we met, we talked, information was presented. As JB said, we believe we were highly cooperative in the space. We believe we were working towards a solution. We were expressing we did not feel as though the current intervention was netting the result that it was being offered to us. It was presented as only in emergency circumstances and only in specific circumstances, as you said, running into the street. That did not appear to be the use from our perspective that was being provided. As we raised concerns about that, we were under the impression a new intervention was going to be created. That new intervention was dismissal. That feels very awkward as a parent who feels as though you're trying to collaborate in the space.
Thank you. I appreciate the response there. And I do understand around the ECM side. Did you have any comment about the meeting in 2022 to review that FBA? Did you feel that was collaborative early on?
In August 22, we're very early on in the process.
Okay.
So at that point, you know, we have all hope and all systems go for the preventative strategies that were outlined. And they didn't really go beyond what were sort of the strategies that would be in place in any setting serving students with disabilities. A token board is fairly commonplace. Use of a visual schedule is commonplace. And these strategies have been very effective with our son in the past. But as all of you know, motivation and determining that motivation so that reinforcers are kept salient and meaningful for children requires some pivoting, and it requires constant assessment and evaluation. And so while the early behavior intervention plan in August of 22, and this was before any of the holds and any of that behavior began. I think that it was a functional relationship between the staff and us as parents. It appeared that they had a good plan in place. But what I would say is, was it implemented over time? And when it was determined that it was no longer effective, was the same attention that was given to that plan in August 22 the same effort and attention that was evident in 23 when the holds began to be the regular go-to? So what I'm saying is, while there may have been an early iteration of the behavior intervention plan that looked solid, that appeared evidence-based, perhaps there was an implementation problem. Perhaps there was an inability to engage in ongoing data-based assessment and decision-making, so that we can pivot, we can dovetail, we can make modifications, we can move forward. But instead, we pivoted to what I believe was an over-reliance on PCM strategies or management. It's not a strategy. It's not a pedagogical approach. Helton told us she uses PCM to teach JJ to have a calm body. It's not a teaching methodology. It's not a pedagogy. So in answer to your question, a little long-windedly, I apologize. Yes, I acknowledge that the August 22 plan, I agreed. It had those components of what I think are things that you would expect to see in a classroom that is helping students who need salient reinforcement, who need systems of reinforcement that are meaningful for them, that help them to engage in target skills. But I would say that lasted for a few months. And when that was no longer effective, that's when I feel like the lack of competence was really becoming apparent, because there began to be many more reports around the use of physical management. And I thought in my mind, what happened? What happened to all the strategies? What happened to let's try something else? What happened to that list is never exhausted. Those efforts, the failure Skinner says is that we give up. We stop trying. We stopped coming up with other interventions, and we moved to what ended up being very punitive approach that actually trained JJ to behave aggressively with all of the adults around him, which he continues to do to this day. So we're trying to undo a lot of that. But early on, yes, and I had hoped that that kind of approach would continue, that we would do another functional assessment and see what other environmental variables, those are the things we can control. What other environmental variables can we manipulate? And in fact, I said to them at one point, if you didn't have the physical management at your disposal, let's just say you weren't allowed to do it, what other things would you do? Have that reflective, you know, introspective conversation with yourself and see if you can come up with other strategies. But the idea that, well, we tried, it didn't work, so now we're moving to physical management, to me is not the job of BCBAs. I think we can always continue to push that door open to other strategies, because that's what these children deserve, and that's what our field prides itself on. And that's what I did.
Let's take a break right there. So I want to go to the incident reports. You know, I went through the incident reports that are shared. I know that there's discussion of, you know, most of them getting to you within 24 hours per their guidelines. There's the issue of maybe one or a few not making their way to you.
They were often the next day, often. Yeah. So we were left to interpret and guess what might have happened to him. We don't know. We'll have to wait for the incident report.
Yeah.
And so, to speak to the idea of hyperbole, JB described that incident, and it was taken directly verbatim from the incident report. So it was not hyperbole. It was from the incident report that Marrero provided. I just feel the need to share that. That was directly from the incident report. He didn't come up with that and then embellish it with other, you know, with a thesaurus in his back pocket.
In terms of the incident reports where there is physical restraint in there, and knowing that you got a copy of them, you know, there are times where the complainant is, essentially engaging in problem behavior towards peers in particular. So there's one that's noted in October where there is some physical aggression towards another student. In that particular case, the action taken was physical blocked and moving JJ away from the situation. There's another one where we have shortly thereafter in going out of the October timeframe, one that dates back to late 2022, where again, you have some escalation during a transition that leads to running from a building, as well as then trying to disrobe in a public area. You know, the incident reports definitely come across as like there are some significant things going on. And the reason I bring these up is not to rehash every single one of them, but in reading through the incident reports that are supplied, I would assume that at some point, you know, based on the discussion we're having today, like your radar starts to go up, right? Like we've got elopement occurring, we've got continued aggression, we now have property destruction, all of these things that could lead to, as your husband and I discussed, where that could be a safety issue, right? If it's pulling something off the wall, a shelving unit, if it's, running out of the building where no one can see your son, whether it's lunging or engaging in mild aggression towards staff or towards peers. Like those start to mount, right? And so something is changing. Is this where, when you're kind of starting to see this, is this where you decide that some additional assistance through your private insurance is kind of where you're going? Or what's the trigger to bring in other professionals to kind of give some support to the school?
Gosh, my question back to you would be, if there were increases in the elopement behaviors, for example, well, what's he running from? You know, I wonder if we're not asking the right questions about what was leading to these behaviors, but I'll put a pin in that for now.
if I look at their functional behavior assessment, I mean, I think that they've identified the potential functions. Again, these were August 2022.
What efforts are they making in the environment to deal with those behaviors? So incident reports are great. They do a great job of telling us the behaviors. They can certainly be used in the context of victim blaming, but they don't tell us what the professionals were doing to examine that environment, to modify the elements of the environment, to make changes so that those behaviors would be mitigated. What they tell us is, you have a problem child here. Here's another incident report. Here's another incident report. Hands-on this time, come home with marks. Nonetheless, the trigger for the outside behavioral support was a call that I received from Helton, in which she said, you know, I'm not sure he's going to be able to be in our 4-to-1 ratio, which is their party line. He doesn't fit the model. He may not be able to maintain in the 4-to-1 ratio. And so she called me and she said, as you know, outside behavioral support takes months and months and months to get. So I'm alerting you now. This is something you'll want to look into. And with your resources, I bet that you can. So she didn't exactly say you're going to need to get this outside support if you want your child to stay here. But that certainly was the inference from my interpretation. And so given that there was already outside provider at the school supporting other students, I made an inquiry to see if that provider could also support JJ in the hopes that this existing relationship that they clearly had with this provider seemed to be functioning well for other students. Perhaps it would be helpful to JJ. But that was something that came following a phone call that I received from Helton.
Okay. Thank you. I have monopolized a lot of time, so I'm going to take a deep breath, look back through some of the notes I had in preparation for this and allow other committee members to ask some questions. Thank you both for your candor and for your responses.
Thank you for your questions and for your consideration.
Before we open up to see if any other committee members have questions for the complainant, Ms. Michelson, would you offer a code word?
Yes, Madam Chair, you read my mind. The first code word for continuing education credit is Earth Day. Again, that code word is Earth Day.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Do any other committee members have questions for the complainant before we move forward? Dr. Byron?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be a question also for the licensee, but JB, you might be able to answer it for me. If not, it's okay, and I'll ask the licensees when it comes up. Referencing back to that original behavior plan under the crisis management area, it does say that, again, as Dr. Davey said, if there are significant safety risks, we would, you know, have to do some physical management. But I don't see a criterion as to we've had X number of holds in X number of time, or a hold is exceeding X amount of time. Was there ever a trigger to say, at this point, we call mom, we call dad, we call 911? Were any of those parameters ever discussed with you for a criteria?
No, they were not. And from the incident reports that you have and from our testimony, it was very infrequent that the holds were at least reported to us at issues of he's about to run into a parking lot. That was not the frequent explanatory trigger for implementation of the holds. And no, we didn't have any sort of stopping point at which, you know, we would determine that this was you know, going to end.
Okay. Thank you. In terms of an
approach, I hate to call it an intervention or a strategy, sure. But it's a crisis management in a very rare cases sort of thing was our belief and continues to be our belief. And we did not take exception with hands-on to move JJ or move JB to a safer space because we want him to be, you know, not in a situation where he may be, you know, acting out physically and could harm a peer or could, you know, harm a something in the classroom, you know, something might fall or something like that. So we didn't object necessarily to movement to a safe space and then allow him to process through, you know, hands off wise. You know, he's not got his disability for just the 6.5-hour school day. He's not there to inconvenience the model or the 4-to-1 ratio. He's who he is, and he has his disability all the time, and we deal with it, and his related service providers deal with it, and none of them, nor have we ever needed to subject him to a hold. So we know that it can be done. We know that it's possible. We just don't have professionals that elected to engage him in that way. They elected a route that ultimately has created some significant damage.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. That's all I have for now.
I had one question. When I was reviewing the documentation that was provided, I apologize if you missed this, but I want to kind of circle back around to the kind of like that transitionary period. During that transitionary period, it was mentioned in the documentation that the recommendation was made to have the behavior plan developed by the outside agency implemented in either your home or in the clinic that outside agency was that they had. Did that outside agency continue to provide services in their clinic? I'm sorry if I missed that.
I'm glad you raised this issue. No, you did not miss it. And the answer to that question is no. Following our meeting with the school personnel, we had a meeting the following day with the agency, Frank Frias, as well as the owner of the agency, at which point, again, to our utter shock, informed us, your son can't come to the clinic. We cannot provide services in our clinic. So the idea, well, you can go to clinic. So even if he can't come back to school, which is egregious enough in and of itself, I think he should go to clinic, Helton said. And the next day, after our meeting with the school, we can only surmise that the school personnel and the clinic personnel talked and the clinic decided he's not coming to clinic. Coincidental?
Thank you.
Interesting. And we were offered, you know, we can come in home. And at this point, you know, he doesn't need time away from school. He needs to be in a school setting where he's been successful in the past and where he can access his education. So we said thank you, but we're not going to pursue in-home services at this time, and we'll go from here.
Okay. Thank you very much. Do any other committee members have questions for the complainant before we move forward to hearing from the licensees?
I just want to, can you expand on the conversation when being able to potentially attend a clinical setting to run the intervention plan that Dr. Frias had put forward, the reason for it not being able to be conducted in the clinic that was provided to you from Scottsdale Behavioral Pediatrics, did they provide a rationale, or was it just that they did not have space, or what was the reason behind that?
I'll let JB also add to this, since you were present for this meeting and you have a good recollection of it as well. It was an interesting conversation because we were taken through a number of topics during this conversation, which is why it sort of came as such a surprise. One of the first topics was an attempt to get us to have JJ sit for an intellectual assessment, which seemed out of the blue. We moved past that and said, we don't think he needs an intellectual assessment at this time. And then Dr. Boney, who was present, said, you know, I just don't know that we really have other children that are similar to your son. So maybe it wouldn't quite be a fit. And then he asked about kind of his presenting behaviors, and it just sort of took this odd turn. And he said what it sounded like he wanted to say from the beginning, which was, yeah, your son's not, we're not going to be able to serve your son in our clinic. What's your recollection of that? You may remember more.
I think, again, the issue, both from the chairperson and Dr. Davey from your question, is, again, it goes back to just the in our view, a violation of the transition. You know, again, imagine that conversation we're having about a parent group who's had multiple conversations to try to discuss it in a strategy to try to deal with a particular issue, is coming into a meeting under the premise a new strategy is going to be presented. Dr. Davey, from your question, also from an outside provider that's bringing in additional expertise. So these two individuals are going to present a new plan. And that plan is disenrollment. And the plan is the plan was stated that this would work if we had the space, but we don't have the space, so we have to disenroll. So therefore, we recommend you talk to this provider, of which, as JB said, we met with them the following day with a conciliatory heart, feeling like, okay, we've been disenrolled from this school, but at least JB has a location to continue to get some services, to get supported and deal with this issue. And then maybe there'll be a reacclimation period. But to be told the next day, again, this is not a fit for our place, is a separate issue. I know that's a separate entity than the one we're talking about here, but I do think it connects to the lack of transition plan in that there's no continuity of service. There's no discussion of is the child okay? Is the child we've been supporting going to a reasonable place? For lack of a better term, and not to overstate it, it certainly felt as a parent that multiple individuals who were already in sync together abandoned the process and said, it doesn't work at our school. It doesn't work in this clinic. Good luck to you. And that's what the violation is about. As a parent, that's not the appropriate behavior of individuals who are supposed to be professionals in this space, from my opinion.
Dr. Byron?
Just to add to that two-part question, one, I don't want to make assumptions, but the referral there, was that directly from the current school that you were at? And then secondarily, was there a release of information, like were your son's kind of files, his behavior plan, school records, were those sent to that clinic ahead of your meeting?
I can answer the second question, I think, first, and then maybe you can help me revisit the first question because my eyes got averted. It all happened so quickly. I mean, from one meeting, he was disenrolled from school. I don't know what records were provided to the clinic because it was the very next day, and the clinic also said no dice. So it's possible, but the timing was so swift that. You know, I'm not trying to sort of, you know, get in the headspace or try to figure out what the licensees were doing at that point, whether they were forwarding information or not. I have no idea. But we weren't asked to sign anything. And it's possible that there was already a release of information that had been secure because our outside provider had been there supporting JB for some time. The first question, I'm sorry,
if it was a direct referral, that clinic that you went to the next day, was it a direct referral from the school?
No, not in the sense that I think you're asking the question. And again, I don't want to make assumptions either, but the licensees did not say, oh, yes, this is the clinic they didn't make that referral. So this wasn't part of their, you know, good job transition planning. This just happened to be the provider we already had. Okay. And our expectation was, okay, if they're disenrolling him from school, as the other JB said, okay, that's very traumatic to hear, but could he at least have a clinic space to continue to work on, you know, the school readiness behavior so that we can potentially transition him back to another school setting. So no, I wouldn't say that it constitutes an act of transition planning or referral. This was already our provider.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Are there any other questions? I'm holding off for a second because Dr. Davey, your brain looks like it is turning.
You know, I think I probably do, but I think we need to also hear from the licensees to kind of dig into some of the things we've already got in front of us. I do believe when in reviewing the documents, and I'll go back and check at a break, there was an ROI signed between Scottsdale Pediatrics and the providers to be able to share information back and forth and to share it freely, which would make sense given the relationship at the onset. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe there's also some correspondences between Dr. Frias and Ms. Helton, and I'll have to go back again. There are, I don't know, several hundreds of text messages between the professionals talking about perhaps where the ECM intervention plan might be most appropriate. So I need to look at that, but I think I'll hold those questions for the licensees to explain why I try to get myself organized around those.
Understood. Okay. It is my understanding, and it looks as though Ms. Helton and Ms. Marrero, you are present. It's also my understanding that you are represented by Attorney Sarah Stark, and I see that she is present. This is the opportunity for both respondents to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have questions for both respondents following their statement. You may both unmute yourselves at this time and state your names for the record.
Hi, my name is Elaine Helton.
And I'm Candace Marrero.
And my name is Sarah Stark. I'm counsel for Ms. Marrera and Ms. Helton.
Perfect. Ms. Stark, do you wish to provide an opening statement for both respondents, or will they be addressing the committee with individual statements?
Madam Chair, I think the best way to do this, because there's a lot of information to cover, I think I'm just going to make a brief statement on both of their behalfs and then let you guys get into your questioning, because I'm sure you have some based on the discussion that we've just had.
That sounds perfect.
Okay. Let me know when you're ready.
We're ready.
So I just wanted to highlight a few points from our response. I mean, we did provide a very thorough response, a lot of materials here. But again, you know, I don't think I can address everything that's come up in the last hour in this 5-minute opening. So I'm just going to do the best I can to provide a broad overview and then turn it back over to you guys. JB was enrolled in the school for approximately a year and a half. And as is evidenced by the records provided, Ms. Helton and Ms. Marrera and the school did everything possible to allow him to remain enrolled. What has been most surprising about this complaint is the fact that the licensees were engaged in a highly collaborative process with the parents this whole time. And the vast majority of these concerns were never raised with the school or Ms. Marrera or Ms. Helton until it was determined that JB could no longer remain enrolled in the school after all of the different options, solutions, and strategies had been exhausted without any success. Licensees frequently communicated with mom about the child's progress. They tried multiple different strategies and techniques and even utilized an outside ABA agency for extra support with the hope that this would allow JB to excel and remain in the school setting. With regard to the photographs submitted by the complainant, again, it should be noted as initial matter that the majority of these concerns were never raised by complainant to Ms. Marrera or Ms. Helton or the school staff, and licensees were made aware of the extent of this complainant's concerns during this whole complaint process with the board. As has been stated, the school utilizes PCM for management of crisis behaviors. It's approved through PCMA, and Ms. Helton and Ms. Marrero and staff are both trained, and the staff is certified to implement these procedures. The use of these techniques is outlined in the school's behavior policy, which was provided to parents. Parents are required to give informed consent, and both of those things occurred in this case with this family. PCM policies state that while PCM is a safe system, no system of crisis management can guarantee there will never be injury to staff or to the people they serve. And in JB's case, of the approximately 82 incidents that occurred and were documented during his time at school, only 8 of those reports document the observation of redness or scratching, which could have easily been caused by the original behavior and not necessarily the PCM hold. In addition, of the pictures submitted by the complainant, only 3 even have the potential to be related to the PCM techniques based on the location on the child's body. And again, most of these photos were never shared with Ms. Helton or Ms. Marrero or the school in real time, and complainant never indicated she wanted the staff to cease utilization of PCM despite being highly involved in the process and also being physically present on campus and watching these interventions occur. So to conclude, this has been a very upsetting. It's a very unfortunate situation for all the parties involved. My clients truly feel like they did everything that they possibly could to allow this child to remain enrolled in school, and they acknowledge and understand how devastating this situation was for complainant and their entire family. However, we maintain there are no ethical violations here that occurred, and they did everything they could to try to make this work. That concludes my statement. And again, both of my clients are available for questions, and I guess you can just direct your questions to one or both of them as we're going through that part of the process. Thank you.
Let's start. At this point, we will open the floor for questions from committee members towards the licensees. Dr. Rates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a couple different questions. I think I'll start around the transition. And so if one or both of you can just share with us a little bit about the time leading up to the decision to disenroll. Yeah. In particular, can you share with us a little bit about what was communicated to the family? Can you share a little bit about the decisions around the several days where the individual is asked not to attend? And then some discussion around how that transition discussion occurred and what were the opportunities presented?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and cover that because I was definitely probably more involved with those conversations. Aside from obviously like way back before we even got the onset of a one-to-one provider to come in, as complainant has stated, we did have conversations about the ability for us to manage the behavior and or make progress with our 4-to-1 ratio. So, you know, that was at the end of the 2022-2023 school year discussing like, you know, we, in those conversations, we did discuss alternative school options and other things that could be a possibility, but saying that preparing for the following year, if we want to try with 1-to-1 support where things can be more targeted to him in that way. That conversation was started early on. But as far as like the actual transition time, I know that when we switched to using Prone, the discussion was had on September 29th, where we had determined that our vertical transportation procedures and our vertical immobilization procedures were not effective. There was breakdown. We had other PCM instructors come look at it to give their opinions. We met with the family to discuss Prone. At that conversation, we did say that this would be kind of like a week to week. We're going to really heavily monitor the data. We need to make sure that it's heading in the right direction and that, you know, we're not going to overuse this procedure. And if it becomes a consistency and or the lengths increase of the holds, then we need to look at that. So we did with Dr. Frias, I believe there's text messages about this where he's like, what data do you want to be looking at? We're going to meet every week and really look at that. On November 8th and 9th, we'd started to see that increase on the prone holds. That's where we did meet with complainant, Dr. Frias and I. Well, Dr. Frias and I and Ms. Marrero met to really look at the data and see like what is going on because those times increased. So that was where we kind of had the discussion about an extinction burst. And we said, you know, is there a chance that this is just a spike and it'll go back down the next week? We were, you know, comfortable with where the holds were before that somewhat, as far as like the length of time and stuff like that. So we met with complainant, discussed that this could be an extinction burst, but we are concerned about this. We said we can give it like into next week. I believe I said, I want to see at least 2 days below 10 minutes to see if that really is what was occurring. We said also though, if we need to just say that this isn't the right setting for him, then we needed to have that discussion. And she, with the conversation with Dr. Frias and I stated that she would like to go into the next week and see if we can see the trends and see if it was an extinction burst. That Thursday, beginning of the week was okay, but that Thursday it was a high time again. And we met again with Dr. Frias and Ms. Marrero to really look at the data. And we had determined we felt like the prone was not effective. It was heading in the wrong direction. And we would like to consider alternative options, including alternative placement. We discussed that with complainant at pickup as well. Dr. Frias had said, can I attend for one more day to see if I can really look at everything for the whole day and see what's going on? But he couldn't come that following day, which was the Friday. So we said, is there a way that we can ask parents to stay home that day? I can come on Monday and really look at everything. And so we discussed that with complainant. She said, that's fine. I believe this is that weekend, they talked, or that Friday they spoke, and it was really like, basically like, this is not looking good. From my understanding, I wasn't a part of that conversation. Dr. Frias reached out to me and said, I'd like to really look at everything and create a new plan. And that was sent over the weekend. When I received it, I said, I really need to talk to my team, including my head of school, because there were some things that really would have needed to be involved that I didn't have 100% of a say over. So I said, and he said, you know, if we need time to discuss it, can you let the parents know? So I did reach out to them and said, we need some time to look at this. I believe that was Sunday that I emailed them. I asked them to stay home Monday. We met Tuesday.
Now you can help me understand a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, we have records and have seen some back and forth. I'm wondering if some of these conversations were in person or by phone. Do you have documentation of that? Is there a clear discussion that you're moving to a space where disenrollment may be the next step? And is that clearly articulated somewhere? Again, I did review notes and I don't know that I see that clear discussion. I guess the other question for me is, was there a discussion that this had in fact reached a point where the individual was not safe at school, and so you had to remain home until the new intervention plan was trained and put in place? I'm just trying to get some more clarity around that space.
Yeah. So these conversations were in person, and I obviously, you know, I don't have documentation for what exactly was said. I do know that as I was reviewing the information as well, there is a note. I don't know if I'm allowed to, I'm not allowed to reference anything, right? Or am I? From the
nothing
other.
Nothing that would be considered protected health information.
Okay. So I'll just leave that there then.
I'm looking at our stuff too. There's also emails showing like, can we schedule a meeting? And those are like where we were in person and we were, like those conversations were being had. And so there's emails confirming like a meeting is needed. We need to sit down and discuss like everything that's going on. And
so it's your, what you're sharing and sort of what I hear you saying is you scheduled meetings and it was in those meetings that you feel you had clear communication about timing of potential transition, timing of potential need to pause having the individual on campus while you reviewed things. Is that what you're sharing?
So as far as like asking them to stay home on that Monday, that was due to the fact that it was an entirely new plan that I didn't know. Like Dr. Fraser said, if you approve this, we can start this Monday. But I hadn't talked to my head of school about some of the components of it. So I didn't feel comfortable about, you know, saying that. So I did email and say, I need to discuss this with the team before we implement. So that was with regard to that Monday.
Okay. Can you share a little bit with me around the family's concerns about they shared, they understand the need to transition someone to out of a certain situation. Can you share with me how you guys addressed those concerns that were shared with you when they were brought to your attention?
I'm sorry, when you mean transition, do you mean transport or like transition out of a study?
Transport, sorry, thank you for that clarification. So indicated that they understood the need to potentially at times transport, but we're not comfortable with sort of a different space. Can you tell me how you...
Yeah, so that is somewhat, I think, different than what was originally the request from parents. So I believe there's email correspondence with regards to the FBA that I, or the BIP that I did send originally stating we want nothing resembling restraint or seclusion included at all in the behavior plan. And I believe I did make it very clear that that this is a requirement to be enrolled, that we're able to use physical management if needed. And at that time, all that was listed in the behavior plan was transport. So I can only assume that they meant they didn't want transport at all included. They also said we want nothing resembling a cool down room or anything resembling seclusion to be included, which I stated we can attempt to not utilize that. That is an option that we have. It's an alternative to holds and stuff like that. But originally their stance was nothing resembling any sort of physical management or any sort of seclusion alternative space, it appeared.
Okay. I think I'm done for now, Madam Chair.
So I will lower my hand. I was wondering, you know, I acknowledge that you both work in a school-based setting. Right. And a school-based setting is very different from a clinical setting. There are educational laws that are in place that, you know, are a little bit different than perhaps what a clinic-based program that doesn't offer educational services is required to do. With that being said, however, regardless of where you work, you're a BCBA. Right? You are licensed by the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners. You are certified by the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. So I do have some questions surrounding that transition, and kind of coming to that, you know, we do not adopt practices necessarily from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. We are a self standing regulatory body. But with that being said, there are standards of practice that are generally accepted in our field. And I was wondering if the two of you are aware of the Behavior Analyst Certification Board's Continuity of Services Toolkit, if there are pieces from this toolkit, perhaps, that you could speak to surrounding how you provided what you feel is an appropriate transition for ABA services. You know, that the educational services, you know, I will say that those educational services, I'm not sure that those fall underneath your license, but definitely the behavior analytics services that you were providing. There was an FBA conducted, there was a behavior intervention plan conducted, there was the expectation that you were collaborating with another behavior analyst from another organization. So I'm going to kind of quit talking about that. But are you familiar with the Continuity of Services Toolkit provided by the BACD?
Is there something specific that you want us, like, from that toolkit?
I would say I'm not familiar with that exact document. I did like go on the BACD and look for some things that I had heard about, but I'm not familiar with that exact document. However, with regards to our behavior analytic responsibilities for continuity, I think that another layer of this is that we had essentially transitioned the comprehensive treatment and care, like primary, to the alternative BCBA that was there, that did their own FBA, did their own treatment plan. They were doing all the skills-based stuff. We were essentially there to like support and collaborate with them at that point. However, obviously it is our setting and transitioning out was a concern. We were understanding with our last meeting with Dr. Frias, as well as our last meeting with Dr. Frias and the parents, that the clinic was an option. And he had stated, I said, is the clinic an option? Is that the best next step since parents agree to this plan already? We like the plan. We agree the plan could be effective. Dr. Frias was under the understanding that yes, absolutely, I can take my clients to the clinic. And that was our last meeting with the parents and Dr. Frias saying, okay, so everyone here agrees that clinic would be the best next option.
So there's been some comments that have been made during this complaint review process that perhaps there was outside communication that occurred between you and Dr. Frias or potentially even Dr. Bonet. Can you confirm that there was or was not communication that had occurred between the two of you talking about not accepting this child at their clinic?
That was never something that happened.
We were informed later from Dr. Frias that he also was not aware that was going to happen. So he did kind of just like follow up briefly saying, I was kind of blindsided as well.
So when we left that meeting, we were all under the understanding that they were continuing services in the clinic. Mm-hmm.
Those are my questions. Do any other committee members have questions? Dr. Davey.
I couldn't find the fake hand, so I had to raise my real hand. with regard to the transition, school setting or not, you know, there's pretty clear guidelines on what a transition looks like in terms of services. So whether you're transitioning them out of the school to a new or alternative setting, whether that's the clinic or in-home services, or whether you're transitioning care from one BCBA to another, you know, essentially the code would say, listen, that you've made appropriate efforts to manage those transitions. That that includes a written plan, right, with some target dates and some transition activities and who's going to be responsible for what and some agreement as to what what's going on. And all of that's there to essentially minimize disruptions to services during that period, right, where you're moving from service provider A to service provider B. Are the text messages the bulk of this transition planning on this team's parts between you and Dr. Frias? Are there other documents? And again, I could have missed them in the packet. Are there other documents that you can point to that said this was something that was thoughtful in terms of, you know, keeping the client at the forefront of making sure we're doing what's best for them? Now, I understand the school setting may not have been what was best, and that can be your contention, but not having a transition plan is not in their best interest. So talk to me about, you know, from your perspective, what's being done to plan this?
Yeah. And again, I'll answer again, because I know the end was really mostly me versus Ms. Marrero. So although I did take her input heavily into account, but as far as that, I think that because the conversations were all in person, and that was a deficit on my end to document that and to really have those conversations that we did have, and I do believe were pretty clear about like what we were looking at and the data we're looking at. And I think, again, some of Dr. Frias's documentation could potentially reflect that as well. He obviously, you know, with the clinic-based setting, that stuff is, I think, you know, more robust. But that's something that we definitely need to incorporate in the future. And even for, like you said, any transition, whether it's someone even graduating, it's something that we have looked into. I've talked with my head of school for developing. And so, yes, a formal transition plan due to the fact that, I guess, you know, yes, we're behavior analysts and we should have been aware of that. We have the kind of the school's way of doing that, but it doesn't cover potentially everything in our ethical codes.
So it's fair to say, like, even, you know, as I pointed out early on, like parents at the school see that there's behavior policy, see that there's behavior, you know, that there's stipulations around behavior that could lead to disenrollment. If disenrollment is going to happen, you know, for any child, particularly a child that's under services from you all as licensees, like even if it's an emergency discharge, right, that the environment has become unsafe for an individual, for the student or for the team, you know, I saw there's communications, you know, particularly late in the 11th hour where you're having conversations with Dr. Frias of like the team feeling that the ECM project is really a step backwards versus a step forward. There's going to be no real instruction. You know, you're asking whether or not you think mom's going to be on board with those kinds of, you know, essentially no demands being placed to be able to get him secure in the school setting. You know, those are all great in text messages, but at the end of the day, like, that's not documented as part of the plan, right? That's not part of like, hey, we're going to have to make a very difficult decision, mom and dad, that we've crossed this line, right? We've gotten to the point of where we are not the best location for this individual. And, you know, and it's fair, right? Maybe you don't know. Maybe you're not aware of what resources you want to point the parents to, right? And maybe you have to make that hard statement of like, we're not sure. Like, we thought, you know, we've been talking with Dr. Frias about this potential, but you'll have to follow up with them. We don't control their intake or their outtake of patients. Is any of this being, you know, whether or not it's just you two having conversations or if it's conversation with the headmaster of the school, like, what is this looking like? You know, this is not in the documentation. So can you, you know, just elaborate a little bit more on how you felt you were addressing this, right? I mean, obviously, looking through the documentation, you've provided us a lot. There was a lot of things going well early on. And then it seems like at the end, there's just this collapse around what is it, you know, what's being documented, what's in the best interest and the collaboration. So help me understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... like I said, I have recognized that as well. And I think that, again, you know, I have been working with my head of school. She's not a BCBA. So she wasn't, you know, maybe fully aware of these obligations either. As far as like to have in our policies with what you're referring to in the behavior policy, you know, it would be great to have something even in there that describes what, if this is the case, like this is what that plan would kind of look like. So there's a lot of areas that I think we can improve
with that. And even though these conversations were all being had via email, text, and in person with, you know, my head of school and Ms. Marrero and Dr. Frias, there isn't a formal discharge report or plan. And that's something that we are changing and actually already have. Yeah, my head of school has also reached out to receive guidance on that. So she's kind of heading up, like, what those policies look like. So we've already kind of self-identified that.
Dr. Davey, would you like to continue this line of question, or can I acknowledge Dr. Byron?
I'm good for right now, thank you.
Okay. Dr. Byron?
Thanks, Madam Chair. From discussions from the complainant, they said the day after they were told their son was going to be disenrolled, they met with the clinic, and that day they were told the clinic's not a choice either. At what point did you two find out that the clinic was not a choice? And then when you found out that it's not a choice, were there any action steps on your end to help secure additional placements, resources, supports for parents?
I'm not 100% sure when we found out. It was Thanksgiving, so we had the meeting on Tuesday, and then we were off Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I do remember that part. So I'm not 100% sure when we found that out, but I did not follow up with the family. The last meeting, it was pretty clear that, like, we don't want to hear from you. There was, like, I had mentioned, like, I have those school referrals that we had already talked about that I could, you know, present to you. And that was declined. It was pretty apparent that there was no desire for continued communication, at least with me. It's something that maybe I could have suggested to my head of school. But
I believe that there's documentation that Frias had provided also that shows, like, that those meetings had happened between them.
Right. And that's what I was saying. That's part of, like, his health records.
But,
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, so that final meeting you had with parents to say you're disenrolled, that was end of communication on your end?
They did reach out to the school as far as tuition reimbursement for remaining things. They did reach out to the school for a copy of our behavior policies that they had signed. And they requested, I think, like, his medications or something to be sent.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Are there further? Yes, Dr. Rakes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I just have one last question around the transport procedures and the use. Did you have any documentation? And again, I apologize if it's in there and I missed it, but did you have documentation of sort of the level of severity for when that would be used versus when other approaches might be used?
It is listed in our, like, behavior policy as far as mild, moderate, severe behaviors for aggression, elopement, and all of that. However, individualized for him, I'm not 100% sure what his little crisis management thing had, to be honest with you. I can look at that. But we follow PCM's criteria of continuous aggression, continuous self-injury, or continuous high magnitude disruption. Our staff is all trained to really analyze each situation as it comes and use the least restrictive procedure for each situation. They're all trained to do that. You know, we put it in the plan and we want to be transparent. We want to be transparent with the incident reports, but we use it as a system across the school, regardless of, you know, just as each situation arises, the staff is trained to analyze the situation and use the procedure applicable.
There's also in some of the modifications too, it said, like, that we would wait within the classroom blocking the doors for, I want to say, 30 seconds during, like, those initial modifications. And so there was, like, clear updates with the families too of what that would look like when we would engage transportation for crisis behaviors out of the classroom.
Dr. Byron?
I asked this to the complainants because I don't see it written in the behavior plan, but again, it's from 2022. So there could have been an update and I miss it. Again, sorry, with, you know, close to 100 pages of documentation, it's easy to overlook. But I see when we're going to use it, but I don't see a tap out point of we've done X number of holds or had a hold for X number of minutes and we are not seeing behaviors come back down. Like, we're not back to a point of being regulated. did you guys have any documentation anywhere of if we have five holds in 15 minutes or a hold exceeds this amount of time, our next step is to call mom or dad for pickup, or our next step is X, or if behavior escalates to this point, we're calling an emergency 911 case. Is there documentation there of when we make a determination that that holds are not effective today in this moment and we're terminating service for the day?
Sorry, that was for the complainants, right?
No, that's for you too. I already asked the complainants about it.
Oh, sorry. I misunderstood. Okay. So PCM does have those criteria, like in the manual, and our staff is trained on that. It is the amount of time that they recommend to then back off and reassess. If you're looking at the times for some of the holds and the incident reports, we did count like as he was calm and we were fading as an end of a hold. If we had to go back in, then that was another hold. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it was like, you know, five separate holds, but we really wanted to kind of identify because of the situation, we wanted to identify like how often we were attempting to fade and having to go back in. So just some clarification on that. But we did not have that in his like crisis management plan, like I said, on his behavior plan. But PCM does have pretty, you know, structured rules around that.
And were you in compliance with the PCM manual?
Is that the documentation around like 12 minutes that I read on the PCM side? Is that something that I remember?
Are you referring to 12 seconds? The 12 seconds refers to fading out completely of a hold within 12 seconds, because each step, each prompt is 3 seconds of calm and then you fade to the next one. So there's 4 total. So it's 12 for fading out as calm maintains. But the, I believe it's 20 minutes that if you're in a 20 minute hold, you need to release, reassess, and watch for signs of distress and then go back in if necessary. But we never reached anywhere near 20 minutes for a hold for one continuous hold.
So I am not certain if licensees, you're privy to all of the information that the committee has, but the complainants submitted some documentation from other service professionals, from occupational therapists, from physical therapists, from speech language pathologists, at outside organizations. The complainants have already mentioned that they feel that the behaviors could be managed without the use of like therapeutic holds, physical restraints. You know, the other service providers kind of provided some of the strategies that they utilized to prevent things from escalating to that point. Could you speak to, well, first, have you seen those documents?
Yes.
Can you tell me what made your setting different?
Yeah, I can.
That essentially made it where you felt his behavior might have been different in these settings, or what, you know, what was different? Let's just go that route.
Okay. So when we're looking at what they had provided from the outside providers compared to what we have available in our setting, we are school, there are other children around. From what I can tell, he was receiving fairly short sessions with the other providers when a one-on-one setting where parents were present throughout that, I think it was like typically 30 minutes or so that they had documented. We are a school. We are a pretty traditional school in terms of academics. We have reading, math, language, we have science, art, all of the things. It's like a pretty traditional school day. You go from class to class. In terms of like what our role is trying to really help the children access academics and access what you would typically receive in any kind of school, right? Playing with friends, going to classes, interacting with your teachers. And so we're not on a one-to-one basis with him in our setting for short, like small sessions. Again, where mom is present, it's mostly like during lunch, but she's not sitting in the classroom like during reading, where it appears that she is there for those other therapy options.
I would say, as she mentioned, like our demands and tasks were likely very different, whereas a lot of those involved, like they were kind of play-based and stuff like that from what I read in the notes. And they also did report, as it looks like, that demands could easily be changed or removed if behavior started to escalate. Whereas in our setting, if there's peers involved, for instance, and I noticed one was a turn-taking gameplay, and as he became agitated, that he was able to finish the rest on his own. We wouldn't be able to do that in our setting because the peers' turn, it's not fair to them. So we would have to kind of work through that separately. So I think the individualization is the biggest part. Mm-hmm.
Are there further questions for the licensees?
Can you talk to me a little bit about the cool down room?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the cool down room is a sterile room. There's no objects to throw or injure in that sense. For this student, this was mostly used to be able to more easily block behaviors to, especially for disrobing was the biggest thing where we needed to try to maintain dignity and safety in that aspect. This one is directly next to his primary classroom. So really, very close. And we utilized it in those crisis situations as a tool. Do you have any specific questions about it? Sorry.
Yes, in terms of, trying to understand kind of some of the discussion around the seclusionary issue. Is this something where there's still individuals in proximity? Like reading through some of the documentation, it appeared that it's not like it's behind a closed door locked down. Like there is an individual nearby the student. Like talk to me a little bit about like what this looks like functionally.
Yeah, there were no peers in there, but he was never in there alone without an adult. And most often it was multiple adults. With him.
Okay. And so when I'm looking back at the 2022 FBA, attention escape to X or escape into a secondary of attention, like in terms of that really being appropriate, talk me through like the rationale of kind of the risk benefit of isolating him from his peers with adults essentially in a room with them.
Yeah. So initially, I would say that the change of really utilizing that room was the disrobing. Because of the dignity piece. And we did try to allow a little bit of disrobing and take his time to put his clothes back on. So we did try multiple different options for the disrobing. But before the disrobing really started to become an issue, we tried not to use that room again with the function being escape that had the potential to gain reinforcing value. And I think that the difference with, we tried to, as you can see in some of the email documentation with modifications, we tried to take into account that function of escape and try to mitigate that. But I think that's where the disrobing piece made that difficult. And that was kind of, I think in that third quarter, that was kind of one of the turning points when that behavior started to increase.
I have just one final question, Madam Chair, and that is, and I want to go back to the transition period. Was there anything that this committee should be aware of that hampers your ability to uphold the community standard of care in terms of properly transitioning this young man?
I would just say the only thing is, as far as if you're talking about checking back up, I would say that just the way that the relationship, the way the last meeting went, I would say that could be the only thing.
I would go back even a step further, right, to the planning, right? Like what made it so we could not get some of this on paper? Like, hey, behaviors have gotten out of control. The school can't handle this, mom and dad. Like it's to a breaking point where, we don't feel like we're doing a good job for your son. We don't feel like our staff are able to handle this. We don't like the new plan per se. Like that doesn't seem to be a good fit for our culture. What stopped you guys from kind of creating that document and having that kind of conversation?
Yes,
I was going to say, I think part of that too is because SPBS was the primary on that case at the time, and he was continuing services with SPBS. I think our thinking along that line was there was still continuation of services because he was still with that primary care provider. The setting had just changed. So he was no longer within the school. He was transitioning into the clinic. But the programming was still going to be primarily with Dr. Frias.
So your contention is that Dr. Frias was the primary BCBA on this case, regardless of setting?
I think that's just a factor. I will say from my end, and again, I handled most of the end, so I just kind of want to take that on as my responsibility, is that I think for me, that was part of it, is that I was really heavily communicating with Dr. Frias, and I potentially was at the risk of not as much in the documentation side on our end. But I think because of how many in-person conversations we had and how, from my perspective, there was clear understanding and, you know, it was a miscalculation on that point, but nothing, obviously, I don't have really a reason for not just creating a document that documented our conversations and our reasonings and our recommendations and what we thought the plan was, which was the clinic and all of that. I mean, that document should exist. I agree. And it will moving forward.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Dr. Byron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to beat a dead horse, but I do want to go back and get just some more clarification for the PCM. I know you said the policies in terms of the behavior policy are shared with parents, but in terms of the manual where it's saying that we can have holds up to 20 minutes. First question, is there criteria for individualization based on a client's their age, their height, their weight? You know, obviously a weight of a young child is very different from a teenager. Are there individual criterion that the manual recommends that you apply? And then secondarily, were parents informed, not just were PCM trained, we're going to use the PCM approach, but were parents informed that we're going to use holds potentially, and those holds can be up to 20 minutes at a time?
So with regards to your first question, there are medical, I guess not medical, but signs and medical reasons to watch for. They have those listed out very clearly for during a hold to watch for those. And if you do immediately release, those include, like, obviously a limb turning blue, that kind of stuff, troubles breathing. So that is definitely in there. And again, we're trained on that. In the conversation that we had, I do believe I did bring up that they can go to 20 minutes. I didn't foresee that ever being an issue. And I expressed that, I've been doing PCM a long time in a couple different settings. I've rarely seen that happen. So I did express that to them. But again, as far as documentation in our PCM consent form, I do not believe that's in there.
Okay. So just a vocal, we just pass it on verbally to parents, but not part of that informed consent piece. Is that accurate to say?
I don't know for sure that it's not in there, but I don't think that it is in the form. Yes, correct.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. I do want to take a moment to check in. This complaint review was scheduled from 12 to 2. We are about 2 minutes away from 2 o'clock, and I do want to be respectful of everyone's time. So with that, I want to check in with committee members as far as who has a hard stop and what time is your hard stop. No one?
I'm okay to keep going. Could we have like a 2-minute comfort break? Would that be possible, Madam Chair?
I think we can have a 2-minute comfort break. I will tell you that I have a hard stop at 2:30. So with that being said, I know we would still have 3 committee members who would be present if I have a hard stop. But from what I am gathering, there may be some additional information requests needed. There may be some additional conversations that are needed at a follow-up meeting before this matter can be adjudicated. But yes, how about a 5-minute comfort break? And then we will return for another short duration.
Great. Thank you, Madam. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Davey, oh, there you are. Okay. It does look like board staff have returned and all committee members have returned. I see the complainant, I see the licensees, I see our board's attorney. So I think we are ready to resume this meeting. At this point, before we just hop back on in, we have passed the 2 hour mark. Ms. Michelson, would you like to offer a code word?
Yes, Madam Chair. The second code word is glacier. Again, that code word is glacier.
Thank you. On the break, I have lost my glasses. This is going to be fine. So as a reminder of where we were before we took our comfort break, we are at the point where we have heard from the licensees. We are, as a committee, having some questions for the licensees. We have not moved into deliberation. We are still in the information gathering phase. So do committee members have additional questions to gather more information from the licensees? Okay, I'll go. I try to wait for other people and be polite as the chair, but I'm just going to dive in. Dr. Byra was discussing a little bit about, you know, do you feel like you followed PCM strategies, the guidelines that are set out for those holds? You know, obviously there have been concerns brought forth from the complainants about the injuries that their son sustained, presumably during these holds. You know, the photographs that are there that were provided, you know, they show fingerprints on the arms. You know, they're relatively clear from my perspective as far as a hand caused that injury. So as we're looking at this, I think that I would like some more information surrounding PCM. What are those policies that are in there? I hear you kind of saying that, but perhaps that could be something. Did I miss that?
Madam Chair, I was just going to interject and say that there's a 300-page PCM manual that we went back and forth about whether or not to submit as part of this. But considering the volume of documents that was already in this case, we decided to wait and see if you guys wanted to see that specifically. So we're happy.
And I don't know that it's the entire PCM manual. Perhaps it is the sections that are germane to holds. But I think what I'm looking for here is whenever we see that, for example, a behavior analytic program is not going the way that we want it to, right? One of those first best practices is to ensure there's fidelity to our program, to ensure that things are being run the way they are supposed to be run. Right. Were there those fidelity checks essentially from a PCM instructor or from either of you to ensure that the holds were being done correctly at the appropriate time, given the school's behavior policy for escalated behaviors or non-escalated behaviors? You know, as we look in there, you know, we've got a couple of different areas that we are juggling here with storyline A and B and C between the transition, and we're looking at the process of the FBA is being conducted, and we're looking over here at least restrictive interventions. So, you know, as we look at this, I'm going to summarize my questions here. And I'm going to put it in two parts. So first question was, were there documented fidelity checks for the behavior intervention plan that was in place that Ms. Helton, you developed?
Hi. So we don't, we did start fidelity checks with our new electronic data collection system in January. Prior to that, we were paper data, and I'm not sure if there are any raw data from that, any of those that would have been created as far as like formal checklists. The BCBAs do have, especially back then when there wasn't that one-to-one support, you know, they have a relatively large caseload, and their supervision is kind of like in the moment when they go to support
and watching it and providing feedback. But the we did start to try to do that with like in a more formal checklist point in January. However, I'm not sure with our, we were trying to figure out our new electronic system, and I'm not sure that those are there right now. We kind of dealt with some issues.
Let me, because the timeline is kind of skewed in my head a little bit as yeah. far as when, which January we're discussing here. So
okay.
In that time period where behaviors were escalating, where you were saying, oh my goodness, I need to do a prone. Oh my goodness, this is not working.
Oh, I see.
During that period.
Okay.
Were there like fidelity checks being conducted where you're saying like, yes, these strategies that should be working are being implemented.
Okay.
Like that process.
Yeah. So I guess I was confused because when we went to prone, that was when Dr. Frias's team was overseeing like the treatment. So like we were collaborating with him on what that could look like. But at that point, we really were providing the crisis management piece while his one-on-one technician ran his program, if that makes sense. And if you're talking about a fidelity check with as far as PCM, we did have our other PCM instructor come look on, I believe, September 29th and October 23rd to look at everything and watch. I had her come up during a crisis to look at everything. But we didn't have like a plan from us in place as far as we use the PCM strategies as our staff was trained. And whenever our crisis management team would go, they were using the PCM system. But our teachers were kind of just supporting whatever the technician was doing with Dr. Frias's programming at that point.
Follow-up question here. I'm not sure how I'm going to say it yet. I worked in a special education school, like a private special education school, as a behavior analyst for a few years, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like I kind of know some of the answers to these things, but I don't want to assume anything. Okay. Was it the school stance that the outside FBA was adopted by the school and the behavior plan was meeting the individual's rights, like educational rights? And we're not talking about like, I'm not an educational lawyer and please don't think that. I'm just trying to look at, you know, it sounds like we're having some conversations about who is responsible for this mm-hmm. child's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for some clarity here.
Our school-wide like ABA techniques at that point, I feel like was what we were providing. So like we were providing the setting, we were providing the educational aspects, and we were providing our school-wide ABA techniques for, you know, motivation and all that kind of stuff. But as far as individualized comprehensive treatment, we had, our staff was under the impression that like feedback given by Dr. Frias to them and to their technician, and even feedback given by the technician to the teachers, that was the treatment that was occurring for the behaviors. Yes.
And I'm going to ask a loaded question, so get ready for this. You said you have a very large caseload. What's your caseload?
I am the director, so I don't have a caseload. So I help with higher complex situations, so like this one. Our VCBAs have a caseload of 32.
And that includes providing FBAs, behavior plans, fidelity checks?
We have a ratio that we try to keep we have like a tiered system of support that a student needs. We have about 10, 10, 8, 4, as far as that 32 being split up, that's what we try to keep it. And if we need to move caseloads with our BCBAs, so 4 are, we try to keep it about 4 that have severe, like it behaviors and FBAs and more significant needs.
Other committee members, do you have questions? Dr. Byron.
Thanks. I pulled a Pulled a Dr. Davey there. Mm-hmm. Couldn't click my reaction button fast enough. I just want to confirm what I think you told Ms. Denton. So we had a behavior plan back in August of 2022. And at that point, we were doing paper data. And then at some point of some January, I'm not sure if it's January 23, we went electronic. But are we saying that there's no data for any kind of treatment fidelity between August and January that's available? Or we did it, we just can't find it?
And Ms. Helton, before you respond, can you just clarify what January we're talking about so we have an understanding of the timeline?
Thank you. Yeah, I think there was only one January, but okay.
Dates blend together, so
yeah, that's okay. Like I said, we were kind of really trying to build up. We are a newer program, not 100% new at this point, but we were trying to really kind of figure that all out. And we were realizing that paper data was not going to be sustainable. So I honestly am not 100% positive. We had binders back then and we were really trying to like get a system in place. We realized we need an electronic system. And then we shifted between December and January. So it was a odd timing there. So to be honest, I am not 100% sure if we did or if we have it. I know that I remember what our plan was and what our strategy was with the binders, but it was a difficult time frame.
So, you know, documentation being able to be found or not, like as the director there, we were overseeing some of the trickier cases and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have recollection of doing overlaps where you are monitoring staff, you have your behavior plan that you wrote in front of you? Was that correspondence checks going on of, yes, they're doing high probability. Yes, they are utilizing the token board. We are doing this with high fidelity. And if yes, was that consistent from August through November?
I was constantly in there, at least daily, and always looking at the plan and how it was working. As from August to December, there was strong fidelity and those graphs do show steady progress. We were working through the different phases. They were feeding out the visuals. All of that was going really well. From January to April, we modified the plan, I think, 3 times to really try to account for some of these things that we were seeing. And again, both Marrero and I were heavily involved with the staff to get that in place and then make sure that everyone was trained up on it. Especially we have three floating behavior support staff that we would definitely make sure they were fully trained on it too, so that if they went to a call, they knew exactly what was occurring. But it did change a lot. And then in April, and again, this is not our response, but in April, when we determined that we needed support, and that we couldn't manage it necessarily, we did back off a lot from demands, from anything that could potentially trigger the behavior. From April to May, then, you know, as far as that plan, we were watching as well. When June rolled around, that's when the other team took over. And again, I was collaborating with that BCBA, but that one-on-one technician that was running the programs was directed by their BCBA, Dr. Frias.
Okay. That's it for now.
So, Madam Chair, kind of to your foreshadowing there of some information that I would be very interested in is most likely going to come from Dr. Frias around some of the activities that he was engaged in, particularly around the transition planning. I know you already hit on some other documentation, perhaps maybe some of the safety mechanisms around PCM. Like, do we want to take the next 10 minutes or so before you stop and think about what this request for records might look like?
I think so. With this, I presume there needs to be a motion made to table this, and then discuss the additional documents that would be requested before we add this back to another agenda. Does that sound right, Mr. Pulver?
Yes, Ms. Denton, you are correct. You Wonderful. Make a motion, table. In your motion, these are things we want, or you can say in your motion, we'll table. and then whomever, maybe you or the committee, give responsibility to say, this is the things that we need to get.
Excellent. Okay. So I make a motion that this complaint review, this agenda item, both the complaints, 24-23 and 24-24 against Candace Marrero and Elaine Hilton are tabled while we seek additional documentation, which will be identified in just a moment. That's my motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Yes, second. One of us is mute. I think Dr. Bates beat me.
Okay, perfect. I think it is now time for some discussion for this matter before we vote on this. So with discussion, I think this is the appropriate time to talk about what additional information would be helpful in adjudicating this matter. I think for myself, some of the things that I would like to see are specific, at least portions of the PCM manual that surround holds, how to prevent a hold, how to, because I'm presuming, correct me if I'm wrong here, Ms. Hilton, Ms. Marrero, there's probably some de-escalation techniques in there, some preventative measures. Okay, so looking at these areas, I don't know how this manual is organized. If you want to send all 300 pages, I'm eager to read it all.
Madam Chair, sorry, I think what we could do is how about we highlight what we think is pertinent to this discussion, but we'll submit the whole manual and then we'll put like the cover pages that we think are relevant here. And then if you are missing something, then you have the whole manual that you can refer to if we missed something that you want to look at. Does that work?
Yes, most definitely. I appreciate that. I would also like to see if there is documentation about the oversight that was occurring of the FBA that was in place before Dr. Frias came in. Like, I understand that there's some conversations we need to have with Dr. Frias, but whenever the FBA and behavior intervention plan were conducted and developed by the school, Ms. Hilton specifically, I'd like to see some documentation surrounding the times that that was looked at, if you can find any fidelity checks that were conducted, because we've got some accusations here that interventions that were recommended were not being followed. And I would like to see some documentation or some evidence to ascertain whether that is a valid accusation as we look through this. Dr. Rates?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that piece. There were statements made of tweaks and things that were done throughout that time as there were changes in the frequency of the behaviors. And so I would like that documentation too. While I see quarter reports that sort of have a large goal to decrease certain things, I would actually like any documentation or information that we have on what were those tweaks and what was happening to address those things.
Am I allowed to say something?
Yes, go for it.
So some of that documentation is in there. We have like emails where we discussed with her some modifications that we were making. And then we also have, some of it is on the incident reports if it was like a change that was made at the end. But as far as like a formal, a new behavior plan written, I don't know if that is something that is there.
I think just look into that request and see what you can identify. If there are things that you shared with team members, training documents, whatever that is, for those tweaks that were put into place, that's what we would be looking
for. Okay. Dr. Byron?
Just to go on with Dr. Rates is requesting, like, if there's indications of those changes with a phase change line and graphs, like, that would also be really helpful for us to pinpoint when indeed those changes happened.
I would also like to, and I don't know if it's a document request necessarily, but I do think that I would like to speak with Dr. Frias. So if we can ask him to attend the meeting, and you know, we've seen the FBA that he supplied, we have seen some of the documentation surrounding text messages that have gone back and forth and emails, and we've seen these things, but I think I've got some questions for Dr. Frias. So I would like to see him at the next meeting if possible. I don't know if we need to subpoena him. Hopefully, I don't know what the desire is. What would be your recommendation, Mr. Pulver, as far as getting his attendance?
Madam Chairman, I think the thing that you're doing is correct. I think you have your motion. In your motion, you put down what document you can say what documents you want. Have board staff send a letter to Ms. Stark. Ms. Stark will provide the documents, and then you can direct board staff to reach out to Dr. Frias and invite him. It may be that he may need a subpoena for other reasons. I don't know if he owns his business or whether he needs to be able to tell whoever owns his company, which I don't know if he does or doesn't own, saying I'm required to show up and go from there. But I think if you, as you're doing now, just explain what you need, direct board staff to send letters so you have documentation so that when people show up, say, these are the things we asked, we don't have them, what's the reason why? They can say we searched, as Ms. Hilton said, and we weren't able to find it. But at least you have what you need. So that's be my recommendation.
And I'm going to continue my questions for you. You didn't know how much I would enjoy your input. If we invite Dr. Frias and he needs a subpoena for whatever reason, can that subpoena be issued outside of a committee meeting, or does that need to? Thank you, Ms. Michelson. I see your head shaking. Okay. So that doesn't have to have a motion and quorum and a vote. It could be. Okay, great.
It's part of your powers that you have to investigate.
Okay, wonderful. So I would like to just invite Dr. Frias. And then if he needs a subpoena, we could go that route.
I think that would be the, yes, Madam Chairwoman, I think that'd be the appropriate way. Most people, when invited to some sort of professional board, would like to comply as professional courtesy. If a subpoena is required, and that doesn't mean any knock on anybody, but there might be a reason why.
You should come to more of our meetings, Mr.
Give
Paul.
Them an opportunity.
You'd be surprised at how many people do not want to come here and might be scared pantsless to come before this committee. Okay, so is there any other documentation or requests before we take a vote on this?
I just would like to piggyback on Dr. Byron's comments around some of the graphs that are discussing, like, percentage of intervals. I'd like to know what those intervals are. I don't think that I found it in there, so maybe just a little bit of understanding, particularly around the progress report where it's like 20% of intervals. I don't know if those intervals are 30 minutes, 30 seconds, or what. So if I could just get a little bit more information, or if you could just point out to me in the 800 pages, if I missed it somewhere, what those graphs are actually depicting. Sorry, Dr. Byron, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Back to you, Dr. Byron.
I don't know if we're allowed, so I'll also ask questions of Mr. Pulver. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about transition plans and kind of the lack thereof in this, and Ms. Helton has said that there is now things in place. Is it appropriate to request, like, what kind of remediation they have taken as a result of this practice and see what is now in place? I don't know if I'm allowed to ask that if it's outside of the scope of this process.
You're allowed to ask. Part of the reason is, as a subcommittee or a committee, you see issues and they come. One of the questions you ask, okay, we have these, I'm just saying hypothetically, we have these issues. What have you done to remediate them? Because if you find issues and say, yes, there's a problem here, if they say, yes, we did have a problem, we remediated, that resolves the issue of saying, of not asking that question, not knowing they're connected. So your answer is yes.
Okay. So if we could add that, Ms. Denton.
Yes, please. I like that idea very, very much. Any other requests? Oh, Dr. Rates.
Yeah, I don't, and I don't know if there are more, and this may be we have what we have, but if there are any additional notes from the last meeting that you had, and if there are any school records related to the, I may not be using the right educational term, but the discharge or disenrollment, I think it would be valuable to see any of that.
Okay. Are we ready to take a vote? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Nay.
And one other thing, Madam Chairwoman, could you have, I know someone wrote this, all this information, could you just have that repeated again to make certain it's captured everything that the committee wants?
Absolutely. Board staff, did one of you happen to notate this to where you could reiterate it for us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have portions of it. And just to note, Ms. Pacanon is having internet connection issues. She just rejoined right now. My understanding, there's several pieces the committee wanted, relevant portions of the PCM manual, any documentation relative to updates to the FBA before Dr. Frias was involved in the care, any documentation about interventions, recommended interventions that were followed, explanation on the intervals for the graphs, additional notes if there are any regarding the last meeting about disenrollment, any discharge or disenrollment paperwork, any remediation efforts by either licensee, and then also sending a request to Dr. Frias for his appearance at a future meeting when this case would be reviewed, which of course that date would need to be determined later on once all information is received and determination made that all parties can appear at the same meeting. If I'm missing anything, please let me know.
Dr. Rates.
Yes, I'm wondering if I can make an amendment to add one more item that I would be interested in receiving if possible. And that's anything that the school has related to the roles of internal VCBAs and consulting VCBAs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. David.
Just, it's my understanding to committee members that Dr. Frias's services were being put through private insurance. Is that your understanding as well as committee members?
It's my understanding.
Yeah. And I guess we're going to get to see all his records. Okay. I think I'm just trying to see if there's something else, and I'm racking my brain in real time, like, what is it that would show us, like, I'm in charge kind of thing, right? So is that something we want to request in terms of prior authorization request that went to the insurance company? Is that, you know, what documentation led to the approval of ours for this particular individual? And so I'm wondering if we need to kind of expand the records request from Dr. Frias to include the initiation of services, including that whatever prior authorization documentation might have been there. And I say that out loud, but I know we did receive some from Scottsdale Behavioral Pediatrics, but I don't know that I saw that in there. So if it's not, I would love to be able to see that.
Are you thinking like session notes?
Not even session notes, right? Like what initiated service, right? So to get to essentially get, there's a discussion in the text about getting 35 hours, right, for services. What documentation was sent to the insurance company to back up medical necessity for that? And then who's signing, like, what's the plan that's being forth there? Is this the ECM plan that they're going to be running? Essentially telling us who's submitting this plan, who's running this plan, who's being paid to implement this plan. I think that would also shed some light on perhaps who's responsible at this point, because that question still lingers of who's doing what? And there doesn't seem to be a very clear line of we were in charge of X and you were in charge of Y. So maybe just an expansion of those, the initiation of service documents from Scottsdale Pediatrics that includes the authorization requests and documentation sent to be able to receive authorization for insurance services.
Dr. Davey, I did see some authorization from insurance in the folder, so I'm not sure.
I saw that from...
I'll double check it, but can we, for the sake of time, can we include it? And if it's already in there, then we can back it off. I'll go in and check and email you privately, Jennifer, if it's in there.
That works, Dr. Davey. Thank you.
The other thing, Ms. Michelson, that I had requested was if there is documentation of fidelity or oversight of the behavior intervention plan being implemented before Dr. Frias. By the BCBAs specifically. Dr. Davey, are you leaving your hand up or
no, I'm
do you
done.
Wish to lower it? Okay. Do we need to reiterate that again, Mr. Polder?
Yes, Madam Chairwoman. I think you need to reiterate that you may want to do is make your motion or amend your motion, have a second, and then once again have, excuse me, Ms. Michelson, I was gonna say Jennifer, but Ms. Michelson, expand what the list is, and then maybe in your motion or somebody in the motion give you authority if anything else comes up so that, oh, this came to my mind in that way. Otherwise, I think we may be here another hour going through.
Okay, let me figure out how to make this motion appropriately. Do I need to close out the motion that has been made and has been seconded? I can amend the motion.
Yeah, I think there's been am I correct? There's been a vote on the prior one?
Yes.
Okay, so then I would just...
Motion carries.
Motion carries, and then amend your prior right. motion, or you may just say, here's a... I'm thinking right. in my head what I need to say here. I want to make this clean. That's what I'm thinking in my head here for a second. So give me a moment.
You're the clean maker. That's why I'm
yeah.
asking you.
would it be easier, I would just say this out loud, easier just to rescind the prior motion and start from scratch?
Okay. Do I need to vote to rescind the prior motion?
You need a second.
Okay.
I move to rescind the prior motion. It has been seconded. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Nay. The motion carries. Okay.
Madam Chair, you can take from your list the referral. It's in there. I found it. So we do not need the initial authorization for services. It is, in fact, in the Scottsdale Pediatric Behavioral Service folder. Thank okay. you.
Okay. So with this motion, I move that we table this meeting while we secure... Dr. Frias's attendance at the next review, while we are also collecting additional documentation that Ms. Michelson, would you please review as part of this motion?
Yes, I will try to keep this concise, but I apologize. I have many notes that are a bit choppy here. In regards to the various documentation or information that the committee is seeking, first off would be portions of the PCM manual relative to holds, prevention measures, de-escalation techniques, any documentation relative to updates to the FBA that was created by Ms. Helton before Dr. Frias was involved. As you indicated, Ms. Madam Chair, any documentation relative to the fidelity checks in particular, if there's any documentations about whether or not the recommended interventions were followed or not, as that was not clear to the committee. In general, any documentations about changes that are made, tweaks, as the committee mentioned, the quarterly reports did not detail that sufficiently. An explanation on the intervals for the graphs that were included with the response, more context was needed. Any additional notes, if any, from the last meeting with the parents or other professionals regarding disenrollment, any discharge or disenrollment paperwork from the school, additionally from the school, any of their policies, if there are any for internal BCBAs and consulting BCBAs, in general, any paperwork that delineates who was in charge for this care, if it was Dr. Frias. And then lastly, any remediation efforts by either licensee. I believe that captures everything the committee was seeking.
As do I. This is the motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Any all opposed, say nay. The motion carries. Okay, we will go ahead and move to the last agenda item for today, which is adjournment. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay, I will second. All in favor, say aye.
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 All right, all opposed, nay. The motion carries. For the complainant and the licensees and staff, you will be notified by board staff in writing of the next meeting time. And necessary documentation. So you will have it all in writing. It will be coming to you. Okay.